Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Michael Kinch, Associate Vice Chancellor and Director of the Centers for Research, Innovation, and Biotechnology and Drug Discovery at Washington University in St. Louis, about his new book, Between Hope and Fear, A History of Vaccines and Human Immunity. This is such an important topic, this place between hope and fear, this place where people can actually come together and perhaps actually agree that we need more hope and less fear when we talk about vaccinations. It's such a sometimes divisive issue that it seems like people are on one side and the other versus we're on the same side, trying to extend life, trying to prevent illness. Looking forward to this conversation. First, though, we've got some very interesting research that matters, and we're going to dive right into the very first one, which is really about a recent study in the journal Molecular Psychiatry that was looking at junk food and mental health. Do those foods actually increase the level of inflammation in the body? And this is what this particular study was really looking at. Eating the junk food appeared to increase the risk of becoming depressed. And the reason they thought that might occur is because these types of foods actually lead to inflammation. Foods that contain a lot of fat or sugar, processed foods, systemic inflammation. And in that case, they argue that these types of foods are very similar to what you might find from smoking, obesity, lack of exercises, things we talk a lot about on Your Health. And the question was this a causal relation or an association? And they looked at actually multiple studies. We call these sometimes systematic reviews, where they put all these things together, including reviewing five studies that looked over periods of time at almost 33,000 adults from five different countries, including the United States. And they believe that these results are causally. So it wasn't like that people were depressed and then they started eating these foods, which one could see, but that the eating of these foods occurred before people became depressed, and the more one ate of these foods, the more one became depressed. This is certainly food for thought, pun intended, but it also suggests that perhaps as doctors and patients come together and mental health providers and really talk about depression, that maybe diet becomes an important consideration. Maybe we talk about and share data that one of the ways to cut down on chances of depression or to get over depression is by eating foods that do not cause systemic inflammation. I'd encourage Your Health listeners to talk with your doctor about this type of research and what it may mean for your health. Next research that matters really is about screen time, the time that kids are spending on their devices, their times that they're spending in front of TVs. And this recreational screen time has been associated with different really adverse health outcomes. And this is really an important research that was done and published in the Lancet Child and Adolescent Health Journal that was a study of almost 5,000 U.S. children ages 8 to 11 years. And they looked at three different things: the amount of screen time that they had, the amount of sleep that they had, and the amount of physical activity they had. And really trying to understand how that screen time related to the sleep and the thinking patterns, the cognition, the ability to think critically and to do the things that these children need to do each day, and then the amount of physical activity and how these things relate. What they found after this study is that only 1 in 20 U.S. children between the ages of 8 to 11 years met the recommendations, which included 9 to 11 hours of sleep a night, less than 2 hours of recreational screen time, and at least an hour of physical activity a day. Matter of fact, The U.S. children spend almost 4 hours a day in recreational screen time. A third of the children actually didn't meet any of these guidelines, and 41% met only one. So these are substantial numbers of American children. And I found this really pretty impressive, because these things can not only lead to improved academic performance, the physical activity leading to improved attention and memory, these things that are really healthy in the development that we need. And the more of these recommendations, those three recommendations that the child met, the better was their cognition. This has implications, I think, for pediatricians, for family physicians, for parents, for educators, for policymakers. I think it's incumbent upon all of us who are working with young children to begin to think about, should we limit recreational screen time, prioritize healthy sleep, prioritize physical activity to really improve cognition, improving physical health. Important research. We'll ask our colleagues in the health science librarians to put up some links to really understand and let your health listeners engage with this research. Last research that matters is something that perhaps isn't intuitive, but it's really critically important. And this is on the other end of the spectrum, is for people who have cancer. And frequently, we really focus on how do we increase the longevity of people with cancer with drug development, but we also want to improve the quality of life. Unfortunately, the cost of drug development is so prohibitive at times. It's very difficult. And so we want to speed up perhaps drug development. We want to pick drugs that certainly could improve longevity or improve quality of life. And they've taken over time sometimes a kind of an intermediate step, which is the benefit of progression-free survival. So the disease isn't getting better, but it's not getting worse. So until it gets worse again. And that's thought that that may actually be related to people's quality of life. So we could improve drugs quicker without knowing the full outcomes. Along come some researchers who are at McMaster University up in Canada, and they published research in the Journal of the American Medical Association, subspecialty journal Internal Medicine, looking at 40 randomized controlled trials across multiple cancer types, really looking at, well, is this progression-free survival where the cancer is under control, does that actually improve people's quality of life? Because if it does, then that's a great surrogate marker. We should say, do more of this type of research. And I think most of us would have expected they found that. However, they did not find that. At least progression-free survival measured in the short term didn't necessarily predict longer life. It didn't predict improved quality of life here. And so it turns out that probably this progression-free survival, and this was over almost 14,000 cancer patients and 12 different cancer types and all these different studies, that did not show association. So perhaps the next time we're hearing about this, if it's a loved one or ourselves, God forbid, that are in the office and we have this and we're hearing about some of these medications, we probably do need studies that really improve quality of life, improve longevity of life, not just the progression-free survival. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. I'm going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Michael Kinch, Associate Vice Chancellor and Director of the Center for Research, Innovation, and Biotechnology and Drug Discovery at Washington University in St. Louis, about his new book, Between Hope and Fear, A History of Vaccines and Human Immunity. You're listening to Your Health. This is Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, I'm talking with Dr. Michael Kinch, Associate Vice Chancellor and Director of the Center for Research, Innovation, and Biotechnology and Drug Discovery at Washington University in St. Louis, about an important new book he's written called Between Hope and Fear, A History of Vaccines and Human Immunity. Welcome, Dr. Kinch.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk.
You know, this is not the first time you've been on Your Health, and I have to thank you for writing another book. For our listeners who may not have read the first book on drug development, which we had a fascinating conversation a year or two ago about kind of the real needs in drug development, tell us a little bit about yourself and your path that gets you to the point to really tackle the pressing issue of vaccinations.
I basically started out, I got my undergraduate degree at Ohio State. I grew up actually in the town where Hillbilly Elegy is set, so I'm one of the survivors who escaped. And after I got my undergraduate degree at Ohio State, I did my PhD down your way at Duke, and then was a postdoctoral fellow at the Leinberger Cancer Center at UNC Chapel Hill. From there, I actually did the classic conventional academic thing and became a professor at Purdue University, where I studied breast and prostate cancer. About a year after I got tenure, I was recruited to a small biotechnology company, perhaps 150 or people or so at the time, to start an oncology program. And this company was, the name of it was MedImmune, and MedImmune became, over the next 5 or 10 years or so, one of the largest biotech companies in the country. And we were developing a number of different drugs against cancer and various infectious diseases. And I actually continued that work at a small biotech, focusing in this case on infectious diseases, which is reflected in the book. But we were studying some rather exotic diseases like Ebola and Marburg and Rift Valley fever and diseases that hopefully will never reach the United States, but probably inevitably will. And from there, I was recruited to lead drug discovery at Yale University and remained at Yale for a number of years, trying to address what we call the valley of death in drug discovery, which basically is a dramatic way of stating we don't know where new medicines are going to come from. The costs behind developing a new medicine have reached a point where it now requires many billions of dollars to develop a single new medicine, and the resources available to do so are increasingly limited. So from there, I continued the work, actually, for the last few years at Washington University in St. Louis. I was recruited by a former chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill, Holden Thorpe, and have been there for about 4 years now.
Yeah, well, it's remarkable to see the connections between the discovery of medications and the cure for disease, and then even thinking about now the prevention of disease. How did you get interested in immunizations? Because it's not an obvious translation as we think about translation of science that people move from one career of treatment to a career that maybe is more about prevention.
Yes. Yeah, so when you talk about infectious diseases, the real key is if you can prevent them, it's infinitely better from a medical standpoint, an economic standpoint, and a treatment standpoint than it's better to prevent than to try to treat. That's particularly true with viruses because oftentimes the symptoms that are caused by a viral infection are actually reflecting a fairly mature infection in which the virus is doing the damage, and by then it might be too late to intervene. So the ideal situation is to try to prevent that, and obviously the best way to prevent a infection by something like a virus is with a vaccine.
So if we think about the top 10 causes of disease in the world, how many of them are amenable to vaccinations?
Of the ones that are remaining, probably most are not, and that's actually good news in that the diseases that used to kill us are largely vaccine-preventable diseases, and we've been able to get rid of most of those. So if you look at infectious diseases around the world, the biggest problems are diseases such as malaria and rotavirus, and those are primarily in the developing world. And in the case of rotavirus, there actually is a vaccine, and the key there is to be able to get it into the people that need it the most. Rotavirus causes a diarrheal disease that can kill, especially a small child, extraordinarily quickly because they dehydrate very, very rapidly, and that causes tremendous problems. So we've been able to decrease the death from, if you look at what would have been the major killers of all time, smallpox is a great example of a virus that actually was probably the leading cause of death for our species of just about anything else in history. But through vaccination, we've been able to utterly eradicate smallpox, at least as it exists in the wild.
So there are people who You know, throughout history, probably vaccines have inspired this fear as well as perhaps hope. I take it that your work shows that's not new.
No, actually, what we found, and this is what quite surprised me in the process of writing the book, is that the fear of vaccines actually predates the first vaccine. And that may sound like a kind of irrational statement, but the reason behind that is that the first attempts to prevent smallpox from killing you was a process known as variolation, where you would take an individual that had smallpox, which is a disease characterized by lots of pox or blemishes all over the body that become pus-filled. They would take some of that pus and they would intentionally scrape it underneath the skin of a healthy individual. And that was sort of passed down from generation to generation. And while the individual who was being variolated would get sick, they usually wouldn't get a disease as bad as if they had caught the disease on their own. And so, but the problem was that roughly 10% or so of the people who were variolated died. So this was not a happy procedure. And there was a very strong anti-vaccine movement to variolation, even though the first true vaccine, which was also for smallpox, and it was derived from a cow, because it turns out that cows have a type of pox virus infection that is, in humans, pretty mild, actually extremely mild, that then the first vaccine, and the word vaccine is actually derived from the Latin word for cow, that was the first vaccine. But by the time that first vaccine was around, there was already a pretty well-established anti-variolation group, and a lot of those worries and concerns were transferred to the new vaccine.
So if we think about the fear aspect, when we talk about vaccines today, it seems as if people just immediately, you know, it's as divisive at some levels as politics, but it's not, because the great majority of people do still get vaccinated. How did it get to be, though, so polarizing? And you could take an example of, for instance, the measles vaccination or the MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella, and autism and those kinds of things.
Yeah, so it turns out, again, if you look sort of at a historical level, there's always been a segment of the population that is fearful of something new. In the case of vaccines, this has gone on from two generations ago. It was the diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, the DPT vaccine. Now it's the MMR. But what's interesting about it is that one of the big problems you have with a vaccine, if you're a physician or if you're a drug developer, is that by definition, you're taking a healthy individual, you're doing an intervention, and you are usually, with a vaccine, causing some sort of a fever afterwards. The fever is tested extensively to make sure that the vaccine is safe, but you've taken a healthy individual and sort of made them sick for a time. Now, you've done that on purpose because you want them to be healthy when a really bad infectious organism is around, and they'll be able to fight that off. So the vaccines have sort of gotten a bad name because you, or some vaccines have, because you've got a healthy individual and you've made them unhealthy for a short period of time. And that sort of, for folks who are apt to reject these sorts of things, they say, well, I told you so, this makes you sick. Now, the problem with it has been that this sort of inherent fear has been coupled with active deception. And what we're experiencing nowadays is with the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, the MMR, where people are rejecting it, claiming that it has an association with autism. And that's actually based on a study performed by an English physician who, to be frank, utterly, completely fabricated his results. And he did so motivated entirely by profit. He was paid by an attorney to do so. And unfortunately, for a period of time, he had a paper that was published that pushed this idea forward, again, to sort of make him some money. And people read it, and this fear, this kind of rumor, if you will, got started. The scientific process being what it is, it was discovered that this was a fraud, and he lost all of his credentials and has been totally, again and again and again, many studies involving many tens of thousands of people have been performed saying that there is no link between the vaccine and autism, but there's still an entrenched group that believes it.
One might call it a libel. a medical libel, but not a blood libel, but something that's damaging and probably deadly to thousands, if not larger populations. We're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue this really fascinating and important conversation with Dr. Michael Kench, Associate Vice Chancellor and Director of the Centers for Research, Innovation, and Biotechnology and Drug Discovery at Washington University, about his new book, Between Hope and Fear, A History of Vaccines and Human Immunity. We'll be right back with your health. This is Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of your health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. And we've been talking with Michael Kench, Professor and Vice Chancellor and Director of the Center for Research, Innovation, and Biotechnology and Drug Discovery at Washington University in St. Louis, about his new book, Between Hope and Fear, A History of Vaccines and Human Immunity. And right before the break, we were talking, Dr. Kench, about this really completely false research that really created a mantra that lives on and the damage that does. I know in your book you talk about measles and the resurgence of that. Is that tied to lower vaccination? Do we know that?
The fear of the vaccines?
The fear of vaccines, people not getting vaccinated against measles, and any, right, we've seen pretty dramatic rises in measles cases in the last number of years.
Absolutely. So what we've experienced really over the last probably 15 years or so, and one thing is that Europe is probably about 5 or 10 years ahead of us in all of these trends, is that we're starting to see a very high incidence of measles, and especially in Eastern Europe. So Ukraine this year, if I remember my numbers correctly, has already reported for 2018 more than 30,000 cases of measles. Again, a thoroughly preventable situation. An interesting part is that 80% of the cases of measles are occurring in adults. And so 20% are occurring in adults, 80% are in kids. And that adult number reflects the fact that for many years, the Ukraine has rejected vaccines. I had one health expert after my book published come back to me and say that vaccination rates in the Ukraine are less than 10%. Now, you're seeing that replicated in Poland. You're starting to see high levels showing up in Germany, in the United Kingdom. And a lot of this relates back to this strong fear of strong government, that and government is associated with vaccines. And as a matter of fact, the five-star movement, the M5S, which was the government recently elected into power in Italy, adopted as part of its party platform, and a major part of its party platform, a clause that said they would not require mandatory vaccination. And so Italy, you can predict a year or two or three or four is going to begin to see a pretty dramatic increase in preventable diseases.
You talked about some of the diseases that people obviously don't see anymore, smallpox, even chickenpox is somewhat eradicated. And some of people I know will say, well, you know, chickenpox was a common disease and it's not really serious, and so people just got it and then they didn't need the vaccination. But that really doesn't hold any sway when you look at some of the major causes of killing today: malaria, AIDS, tuberculosis. These are major killers of millions of people worldwide each year. If we got to the place we have effective vaccinations, will the public use them?
So what's interesting about the three diseases you mentioned is that the people that are most affected by it are desperately praying for a vaccine for each of those diseases. So malaria has a dramatic impact on sub-Saharan Africa and many countries in the developing world. They want nothing more than a vaccine, and they would stand in line for days, I'm sure, to get one. Likewise for HIV and for tuberculosis, especially as tuberculosis is increasingly becoming antibiotic resistant. The interesting trend that we're seeing, especially here in the United States, is that when you look at who is it that's rejecting these vaccines, it tends to be folks that have a higher than average amount of education and a higher than average amount of money. And it's also independent of, you mentioned earlier, parties. because you have a rare alliance where you have a Kennedy in the form of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's an anti-vaxxer, partnered with Donald Trump, who is also an anti-vaxxer. So it crosses party lines, and it appears to be, and there have been some books written that are far better than mine on, you know, what is the background for this rejection. And it appears to a large degree to reflect the fact that with the Internet, a lot of people, especially those that can afford the Internet, are self-professed experts. And they decide, well, vaccination's not good, so I'm not going to do it, or I'm not going to let my child have it.
Well, and I see it most around influenza vaccination, which we have to admit is frequently, sometimes not matched very well. It's not very effective. It, even when a good year, it might be 60% effective. And so you have a year like last in which they said it was much less than that. And I can see how many parents would say, well, rather than cause my child to take something that's not effective and get a shot that's going to cause a little reaction, I will just try to do hand washing and do what I can. What's wrong with that thinking?
Well, so let's talk for a second about what's behind the influenza vaccine, and then we'll talk about an extreme case at the end. So in the case of influenza, the decision as to what viruses are going to be used, which forms of influenza are going to be used in the vaccine for the following fall, is made in the late winter, early spring. So they're basically taking an educated guess based on extensive epidemiology, but making a prediction. And about a third of the time, the prediction is wrong. Now, the consequence of when it's wrong is that you have a susceptible population, meaning that you got a vaccination, but you're still susceptible. And this past year was a good example of that. 80,000 people, 80,000 Americans died of influenza this past year. There was a bad match. So on top of the fact that we need to improve our ability to match it, is the fact that we also need to develop what's known as a universal vaccine, which is a single vaccine that would work against every strain of influenza. We're not there yet, but there is work going on to try to get one, and some folks are getting optimistic that some clinical trials that are ongoing right now will prove positive. But think about those numbers for a second. 80,000 people died last year. In an average year, 30,000 Americans are killed. So that mismatch, you could look at the Centers for Disease Control and the folks who make the decisions and say, well, you screwed up and people died. But you could look at that same data and say, in a good year, we're protecting all of these tens of thousands of people. And if you choose not to get vaccinated, you're intentionally exposing yourself or your child to that susceptibility. So I would strongly recommend an influenza vaccine every year. And the thing that I used to work on some rather exotic diseases, including pandemic influenza, which is a form of the disease that shows up about every 3 or 4 decades and is a very natural thing. When, Lord forbid, that pandemic breaks out again, having prior vaccinations against other strains from previous years could be the difference between life and death for a lot of folks. And so as much exposure as you can get to different influenza variants will increase the likelihood that you or your child will survive the next pandemic. And we're in a very strange year this year because this is 100 years after the Spanish flu. And keep in mind that when people ask, for example, I'm kind of a history nerd, when you ask, why did the First World War end? The First World War ended because Spanish flu caused all the sides to run out of troops, and the Germans happened to run out before the British did. So you can't underestimate the importance of having a flu vaccine.
That's pretty powerful in testimony. You know, you've spent a lot of your career being an innovator, a drug developer, increasing knowledge. What's the knowledge we need to move forward into a place where we kind of come together so that we're less fearful and more hopeful?
I think that we need to, first of all, and this is a time of obviously extreme partisan divide on so many different subjects, we need to recognize and engage the anti-vaccinators that are out there. Rather than saying, well, you're an idiot, I'm not going to listen to you, we need to appreciate the fact that they have strong convictions that are well-meaning. They're just misplaced. And there will always be anything that humans make, they can make a mistake on. And there will be vaccines, and there have been vaccines that have been more toxic. And that's part of what my book talks about, is some of the mistakes that have gone on in the past. But we need to recognize that as a whole, and this is an overused statement, especially since the publication of my book, but there was a statement that we're not sure who I can attribute it to or we can attribute it to, but it's an accurate one, which is that other than clean water, no other human invention has saved more lives than vaccines. And we need to recognize that and save as many people as we can.
Yeah. I also think the only thing, as others have said, we have to fear is fear itself in terms of perhaps the ability. Science is never going to advance forward if we're fearful.
And scientists are particularly bad at communicating science. And we take things for granted, the way our brains work and the way that our system works. Once a fact is established, you move on to the next fact. You don't defend the one that you have. And so we've done, I think the scientific community bears a lot of the responsibility.
Well, we certainly appreciate you being patient and moving to this topic from where you've been. I'm sure this is a journey, and it's a journey that's an important one for our listeners, for listeners around the country. We've been talking with Dr. Michael Kinch, Associate Vice Chancellor and Director of the Centers for Research, Innovation, and Biotechnology and Drug Discovery at Washington University in St. Louis, about his new book, Between Hope and Fear, History of Vaccines and Human Immunity. We want to thank you. We're going to put a copy up on our website. There's been some reviews in major periodicals, New York Times, others. I encourage our listeners to get this book, to look at it, to grapple with it, and to have conversations. Important topic, important times. Thank you so much, Dr. Kinch.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you.
We'll take a short break. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. The House Calls segment of our show today, our executive producer Laura Lacey and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And Laura, if a listener has a question they want us to address on an upcoming show, they send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Easy enough.
Easy enough.
Well, let's listen to our very first house call question. What do we have?
So the first listener says, recently I was in the hospital for pneumonia. I came home and I'm doing great. However, I'm a bus driver and my work said that I need a doctor's note that I was safe to drive again. That seems a little bit silly since I'm feeling pretty perfect. Is that a common thing for them to ask? And do you think I'll have any problems getting a note?
I get requests for all kinds of things. I'm not sure I've gotten that one before,
yeah.
But, you know, there's doctor's notes for all kinds of things. What are some of the more bizarre ones I've gotten? I've gotten one that got low back problems, and I'm traveling on an airplane, and I think I need to be in a first-class seat.
I respect that.
Yep. I was in an auto accident. I need a note, probably going to an attorney to talk about options.
Yikes.
To can I still drive? I've got a little memory loss. I had a concussion.
Oh.
To in this case, I came out of the hospital with what would appear to be something very simple. But, you know, maybe you've got a bus driver for kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe there's a policy that every time you go in the hospital, you know, we have to review safety. I mean, in one case, you might say pneumonia. On the other hand, you might say, well, you might have been on some pretty potent antibiotics. You might have some side effects of these antibiotics.
That's fair.
Maybe you had pain or on a medication for pain and the pneumonia. You know, there's we shouldn't take for granted someone could have been having obstructive pulmonary disease and maybe they their oxygen levels are different. So I think there's on the surface some of these questions seem silly.
Right.
But when I think one digs a little deeper, they're important and I don't think they're silly. I don't think any of these questions are silly.
Well, and it's possible a lot of policies that we think are silly are enacted because actually something happened that made them necessary at some point in time. So,
yep. By the way, I did write the note for the first class back pain saying that the pain would probably be less in a larger seat, particularly if it's on an overseas flight of 6, 8, 10 hours. You know, I think that's probably true for about everyone.
Listeners, make a mental note.
No. Don't come in and see me. I'm calling everyone. I did it one time. I may not ever do it again. It's true. Okay. What's our very next house call, Laura?
I take Cialis for erectile dysfunction and have been on it for several years. Otherwise, I'm perfectly healthy and have no medical problems. Do I really need to go see my physician every time I need a refill? I have a high deductible plan, and I feel like this just costs unnecessary money.
I get it. Yeah. I really understand. You know, there's so many things you think you do really know. You're on a blood pressure medication.
Right.
You know, your blood pressure is doing great. You can monitor your blood pressure. You're on a diabetes medication. You can monitor your blood sugars. Do you really need to come in and see the doctor? Well,
right.
Increasingly, we're saying not always. Right?
Huh. Okay.
You know, we're saying, well, if you can monitor these things and you can relay this information to me, and particularly when we move to what's called value-based care. You've heard of this. We've talked about this on the show, right?
Yeah.
So that physicians may not increasingly get reimbursed in the future for seeing a patient in billing insurance companies, whether you get a global capitated sum of payment, and by keeping the patient healthy, by keeping them out of the doctor's office. So in cases that you can have like really good communication, so medication like Cialis or the other medications for erectile dysfunction, these medicines are really, for the most part, perfectly safe. However, they can have side effects. They can have side effects that are sometimes quite serious. For patients who are older, who have perhaps coronary artery disease or on medications like nitroglycerin, that can actually even be deadly. So it is important to have a conversation to see if any health history has changed. Are the medications still needed? Is the dose the right dose? So a conversation needs to occur. The question is the physician's time valuable? And if you have to have a conversation, once a year seems reasonable. Can it be done over the phone? But then can that time have a value that's agreed upon between the patient, the provider, and perhaps the health system? It's the system we're moving to. It's the right question. Answers today may not be fully satisfactory.
Yeah, and the value-based system wouldn't necessarily preclude, you know, yearly visits with your doctor, like just checkups, would it?
It wouldn't, and you might still need blood work and coming in.
Right.
But it would say that there are certain conditions that we can actually manage without coming in. For instance, there are some medications that you had to come in every 3 months to get a prescription. We can prescribe those electronically now.
Right.
It doesn't mean we don't still need to talk, but perhaps that conversation doesn't have to occur in person.
What an interesting shift in thinking. That's cool.
It's pretty revolutionary. Yeah. I like it for the most part. That's our very last house call.
Recently, I went in to see my doctor for a fat lip. No, I was not hit by anyone. My lip just swelled up. It's the third time in 6 months that it's happened. I initially assumed it was a shellfish reaction, but the last time that it happened, I hadn't eaten any fish. This time, a new doctor said it was actually due to my blood pressure medication and that I should stop it immediately. I found that odd because I wasn't having the reaction daily, but I have not had the reaction since I stopped taking the medication. I just thought others might need to be aware of this information.
You know, reactions due to medications, such an important thing that people don't think about. They think about, oh, I take aspirin every day, so how could the aspirin all of a sudden start causing me a problem? Or I take Advil daily, I've never had a problem, but we know problems can develop. I take a blood pressure medication daily, all of a sudden I get a skin rash. Could it really be the one that I've taken for so long? In this particular case, a fat lip oftentimes indicates an anaphylactic, an allergic reaction.
Right.
Most common medication is actually a blood pressure medication called an ACE inhibitor, A-C-E.
Okay.
And that's where it shows up. Any medication could cause it, including non-prescription medications.
Right.
But certain medicines do it more commonly. So in this particular case, perhaps it wasn't so easy to make the diagnosis at first, but it sounds like the physician got there, is helping you, and got it on track. And so any listener that's got something that doesn't seem right, think about, could a medication I'm taking or have taken cause it?
How interesting.
It's the right question, right?
Yeah.
Well, we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. Any of our listeners can share a question or story by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Michael Kinch. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.